think anybody ought to object to a man going into the woods and cutting wood for pails and tubs and piggins and selling them. That was the way I got my stock.
I never heard Stevens Mouser claim his horse, no sir. No such thing as that. He had been riding his horse too long back and forth between there and his mouser's.
I know it was his because it was right there under his controlment and no one else claimed
it. I understand that legally slaves had no right to property, but my master did not own or even claim a cent's worth of my property.
By 1873, the freed people of Liberty County, Georgia, had waited 9 years to present their testimony before the Southern Claims Commission. In rented hotel rooms, across fence lines, in the backs of general stores across the South, makeshift hearing rooms were set up, and freed men and women were making claims against the United States government for property they'd owned as slaves, property confiscated from them during the Civil War by foraging Union troops making their way through rebel territory. Just 2 years earlier, in 1871, President Grant, with only grudging congressional support, had finally established the Southern Claims Commission, the SCC. Its mission was to reimburse loyal Southerners for their various wartime contributions to the Union cause.
Corn, rice, one wagon, sundry livestock. How did you attain said property?
I bought mine, sir, by taking care of what little I could get.
The Liberty County people testifying before SCC Commissioner Hillier were claiming goods and property lost as a result of Sherman's march to the sea. In the Low Country of Georgia, Liberty County's personal representative of General Sherman was U.S. Cavalry Commander Judson Kilpatrick. In December of 1864, Kilpatrick was ordered to forage for supplies in the area south and west of Savannah, the heart of Liberty County. Despite the war, it had been a good year for local farmers. And, at first, Liberty County slaves were quite willing to share this bounty with the Union Army fighting for their freedom.
In 1864 was a good harvest. The cows was in good flesh. It seemed to us as if the Lord has blessed the earth on purpose to help our deliverer.
Giving provisions to the Yankee soldiers
was a common thing at the time for colored people to do. We thought of nothing but our own freedom and those who made us free.
After the Union Army came into the county, I did all I could in the way of cooking and feeding the poor soldiers. One poor fellow came to me almost naked. I gave him my own hat, clothed him, and fed him.
But things soon got out of hand. A hard frost was set on the Georgia countryside that winter, and shortly after the arrival of Kilpatrick's men, harder realities began to set in.
Sherman's troops was like ravenous wolves that didn't say howdy. They were like a flock of blackbirds, only you could not scare them.
The devil laid a hold of me.
Kirkpatrick's soldiers acted like a hungry wolf and was thick as sandflies.
The soldiers took the necessary military supplies as ordered, but also did their share of plain thievery and plundering for their own personal gain.
The soldiers said, wherever we saw them, wherever their horses made their track, that was free ground, and that they had to eat as they went along.
They had the law to take meat and bread, and wherever they saw, we all rushed there to see what was done. We were so scared, we went in gangs.
When the soldiers left, they took with them movable property. Rice, corn, pigs, dairy and beef cattle, horses and mules, but also buggies and wagons, clothing, beehives, kitchenware, peanuts, tobacco, butter and sugar, tea, syrup, and vegetables, all belonging to the very people they were supposedly there to help, the slaves of Liberty County.
My husband identified his own livestock during the raid. He counted off his cattle from the rest as they went by, from the white people's cattle and the other colored people's cattle.
Massa, you gonna take all and leave me nothing to live on?
We are obliged to. We come to set you free, and we must have something to eat. But you must go to Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam's pockets drag on the ground.
We found ourselves naked as a bird.
Marauding Union troops had been ordered by their officers.
I instruct you to make use of the products of the country in which you operate.
They'd also been ordered to give vouchers to people whose property had been plundered, documenting the kind and quantity of items taken.
Payable at once, if known to be the property of loyal men, on proof that the owner has not given aid or comfort to the enemies of the United States after the date of their receipt.
Some did, some didn't.
They've been digging my potatoes, Lord, they're tramping on my vine. Now I've got a special plan now, baby, Lord, that's resting on my mind.
In early 1865, General Sherman issued Special Field Order No. 15, designating a 30-mile-wide strip along the entire southern coastline exclusively for settlement by ex-slaves. By June, 40,000 freedmen had set up farms there. But by August, President Andrew Jackson rescinded Sherman's order and restored these lands to their former Confederate owners. Freedmen and their families were forced off at Bayonet Point and found themselves landless in an agricultural economy. This, as Congress was still debating the best and least costly way to settle old debts to Southern Union sympathizers. It recommended that the Senate form a special commission
for clarifying these claims, specifying their respective amounts, circumstances, and evidence of loyalty, in order that Congress may know precisely the extent and character of these claims before legislating thereon.
And 3 years later, in 1871, the Southern Claims Commission was established. Three commissioners were named. At an annual stipend of $5,000 each, these were considered plum appointments for the retiring judge and congressman who got the jobs. 160 additional special commissioners were appointed to actually make the rounds of the Southern states to hear testimony and formalize claims. Within 3 days of opening the first SCC office, so many claims were submitted, it was feared
the government will be involved in an immense debt if even a majority of the claims are decided favorably.
In the first month of its existence, the SCC received claims in excess of $2.5 million, and congressmen continued to protest.
Any precedent for their payment would double the public debt.
And it wasn't just the potential cost of these claims that concerned people. The process was cumbersome. Each claimant was asked a series of 80 questions under oath, questions regarding their loyalty, the value of items claimed, and circumstances surrounding the appropriation of the property, including information on the regiment confiscating the goods, where it was stationed, who the commander was, and to what place the property was removed. The goal of this inquest was
to know the condition of affairs at a given place at any period of the war, the state of public opinion, the kinds and degrees of duress and insecurity under which adherents of the national government rested, the opportunities of showing loyalty by word or act, the actual military situation that justified the federal forces in appropriating the private property of the citizens to their own use.
Believing and corroborating an ex-slave's loyalty to the Union did not require either great efforts nor great leaps of faith on the part of SCC commissioners. But part of the process was to ask questions like these.
What were your feelings concerning the Battle of Bull Run or Manassas, the capture of New Orleans, the fall of Vicksburg, the final surrender of the Confederate forces? Where were you residing, and what was your business for 6 months before the outbreak of the rebellion? And where did you reside, and what was your business from the beginning to the end of the war?
Did you work on any railroad transporting troops or supplies for the Confederates? Did you work in any saltpeter works, in tanning or milling, or making clothing?
Black claimants were usually taken at their word on the loyalty issue.
Now my vines is all green, titters they all red. Never found a bruised one till I caught them in my bed. You know they dig in my potatoes.
The whites used to threaten me all the time and often very hard during the war because I was a friend to the Yankees.
I was on the side of the United States. There was no other way for me.
We prayed for the Union victory so that we could get our own time.
I've got a special plan now, baby. Love that resting on my mind.
That last comment, still on record in the hundreds of boxes of SCC testimony collected in the National Archives in Washington, reflects what was to become the crux of the issue for many Northern administrators. Just how was it that slaves could acquire property of their own in the first place? How could property own property?
I know it is hard for some to realize or imagine how it was possible for slaves to own property. You would be astonished to get through the external crust of Southern society and see the inside working of the almost entire business of the Southern states.
Yes, I've got a special plan now, baby. Love that resting on my mind.
Of the 208 claims presented to the SCC by Liberty County residents, 91 were brought by ex-slaves, including 12 women, 2 by free blacks, and only 1 by a white man.
In a small way, a good deal of money circulated among the Negroes, both in the country and in the towns.
There was more stock property owned by slaves before the war than are owned now by both white and black people together in this county.
Some slaves have more property than the Crackers.
Surprisingly, much of the proof that Lowcountry slaves had indeed owned substantial amounts of property came from testimony given by their ex-masters.
He lived just like a white man, except his color. His credit was just as good as a white man's, because he had the property to back it.
He was a substantial man before the war, and was more like a free man than any slave.
But they were not free, and although some slaves did acquire property of their own, at first the Northerners could attribute this only to the generosity of the slave owners.
You let your slaves use your horses to go to church with?
Oh, no. That horse belongs to the old man.
Belongs to him? Why, do they own horses?
Oh, yes. William owns 2, and Robert, I believe, had 3 now. That was one of them he was riding.
How do they get them?
Oh, they buy them.
As hard as this was for Northerners to understand, the fact that property did indeed own property was testified to over and over again in SCC hearings by ex-slave owners.
I never interfere with my people. They bought and sold these things at their own prices and spent the money as they pleased. And this was customary in Liberty County, and I suppose it was in other seaboard counties. I know Mr. K's people and mine used to raise cattle, horses, and more than there was any use for.
This was customary in Liberty County, not because of any largesse on the part of the slave owners there. Liberty County slaves were able to acquire their own personal property because of the way labor was organized in the Lowcountry. There, slaves did not work in the stereotypical gang labor system prevalent in other parts of the South. In Liberty County, slaves worked by task.
They all worked by tasks and had plenty of time to work for themselves. And in that way, all slaves who were industrious could get around them considerable property in a short time.
In the task system, each slave was assigned a certain amount of daily work, generally in quarter-acre increments. When he finished his tasks, he was done for the day. This had been the case in the Lowcountry for well over 100 years before the Civil War, as Northern representatives of the SCC found out.
In nearly all ordinary work, Custom has settled the extent of the task, and it is difficult to increase it. If this custom is ignored, the planter merely increased the likelihood of a general stampede to the swamp.
And the slave owners elaborated.
The daily task does not vary according to the arbitrary will and caprice of their owners. And although it is not fixed by law, it is so well settled by long usage that upon every plantation it is the same. Should any owner increase the work beyond what is customary, he subjects himself to the reproach of his neighbors, and to such discontent among his slaves as to make them of but little use to him.
Why did the task system develop in the Low Country? Reasons varied. Some said that the kind of labor required for cultivating and harvesting their main crop, rice, was different than that needed in other areas of the South. But there were other reasons as well.
The necessity of the master's moving away from his estate in the warm months to escape the malaria involved the adoption of some system of routine which would work with more or less automatic regularity without his own inspiring or impelling presence.
Where a Negro knows that the task he is working is to be worked by him, the next time he goes over the field, he is induced, in order to render the next working as light as possible, to work it well at first.
When a slave was done with the daily tasks he owed his master, what he had left was time.
A good, active, industrious man would finish his task sometimes at 12, sometimes at 1 and 2 o'clock, and the rest of his time was his to use as he pleased.
Oh, Lord, butter, butter. Oh, Lord, yeah. Oh,
we prayed for the Union victory so that we could get our own time.
What did the task-working slaves do with their own time? Their master generally gave them the use of as much land as they could work, and after working for him, the slaves could spend the rest of the day, and sometimes night, working for themselves.
I had all the land I could work. I used to hire men to work it.
We was allowed to work land for ourselves, and was allowed all the land we could tend without rent.
I raised stock ever since I had sense, fowls almost as soon as I could walk.
Slaves worked their own land till the fowls crow for day by moonlight and firelight.
My wife and myself raised this corn and rice together. We both worked by task, and when I had done my task, I went over to her house, and we both worked together. Our son also worked with us because I had a master that didn't put his boys into the field until they were 15 or 16 years old.
The former masters of Liberty County slaves corroborated these statements.
I have witnessed with much pleasure the husband assisting the wife after he has finished his own task, and sometimes I have seen several members of the family, in like manner, unite in aiding those who have been less fortunate than themselves in accomplishing their tasks.
Indeed, much of the proof that Low Country slaves had actually owned substantial amounts of property came from the testimony given by their ex-masters.
I allowed my slaves to own and have their property and have little crops of their own, for it encouraged them to do well and be satisfied at home. No Negro with a well-stocked poultry house, small crop advancing, a canoe partly finished, or a few tubs unsold, all of which he calculates soon to enjoy, will ever run away.
This accumulation and ownership of personal property by slaves, although an acknowledged fact, was an extra-legal arrangement at best. The Southern Claims Commission had its own idea of what constituted property ownership, and it was based on a more industrial economy, with formal written ways of proving ownership. To be awarded a claim from the federal government, freedmen and women had to explain to the SCC how their non-institutional system of property ownership worked. Without a traceable paper genealogy, there were three ways slave communities acknowledged property ownership. Slaves relied on a history of personal and communal usage. on systems of public display, and on customary patterns of inheritance, to secure public acknowledgement of their property rights by both slave and white communities.
I am the only one who had any legal right to the property.
Our masters had nothing to do with our property any more than I had with theirs.
My own master never interfered with me and my property at all.
Every man on the place had property. Our master allowed us everything except guns.
I never heard Stevens' master claim his horse. No, sir. No such thing as that. He had been riding his horse too long back and forth between there and his master.
Regarding my father's claim for 24 chickens, most of them was mine. I raised them all.
I understand that legally slaves had no right to property, but my master did not own or even claim a cent's worth of my property.
I know it was his because every man in one place know every other man's property. He can't help from knowing it. All go in his yard before his door.
No, we stayed door to door to each other, and when we got any new thing, we always showed one another.
I never heard of a master's claiming property that belonged to his slaves. What was his'n was his'n.
A master who would take property from his slave would have a hard time.
I know it was his because it was right there under his controlment, and no one else claimed.
When my master died, some of the young heirs begrudged me my hogs because I had so many more than they did and wanted to take it. But they didn't and could not because it was mine and they knew it was mine.
Some of the slaves had families a good ways off and they used to use their horses to visit them. The master said it was for their interest to have us on horses so that we could get back home to work.
He had 20 head of cattle, about 70 head of hogs, turkeys, geese, ducks, and chicken aplenty. He was foreman for his master and had been raising such things for years. When he died, the property was divided among his children, and we continued to raise things just as he had been raising them.
I am the only one who had any legal right to the property. What was his'n was his'n.
Ex-masters also testified about the way slaves displayed their worldly goods. By storing livestock and equipment openly in their quarters.
Single and double rows of cottages. Vegetable gardens, chicken coops, pig pens, rice ricks, and little storehouses.
Or by carrying goods back and forth from one plantation to another on the weekends, when husbands and wives and children who lived near each other might have the free time to visit.
Saturday nights the roads were filled with men on their way to wife house, each pedestrian or horseman bearing in a bag his soiled clothes and all the good things he could collect during the week. For the delectation of his household.
Or by preserving their best belongings for use only on the Sabbath.
On Sunday, many garnish themselves and go to church for show.
Those on foot carrying their shoes and stockings in their hands to be resumed after they shall have washed in the waters at the causeway near the church. For they believe in treading the Lord's courts with clean feet.
Freedmen, too, testified to the SCC about the importance of their Sunday best.
I had a spring wagon, only used it to go to church on Sunday.
They hustled me around till they carried off some nice linen shirts I used to go to communion in. And they took them, and I grieved. I wanted them to meet the Lord.
At times, the SCC commissioners were said to be harassed, clogged, and fettered by the efforts of claimants, witnesses, attorneys, and other interested parties in their inquiries after the truth. One commissioner reported being skeptical about an ex-slave's claim for 20 cows because
20 cows would make a good large dairy for a northern farmer.
And although the ex-masters of the Liberty County Freedmen were willing to testify on their behalf, there were limits to their support, and there were vacillations, inconsistencies. One ex-master testified about the value of his former slave's horse.
I suppose it was one of the finest in the county.
But quickly edited his testimony when he realized that his high praise might raise the amount of money received by his former servant.
Was one of the finest of those owned by the Negroes.
He went on to state that.
The bed clothing and household effects are valued too high. As a general thing, the bed clothing and household effects of Negroes were not worth as much.
One SCC commissioner claimed that to find the most reliable witnesses,
I go to Negroes because I find I can really get detailed information out of them. They always know if a man was really loyal. They know if the cribs were full or not, often remember the names of the mules, the oxen.
I had a little crop to sell and bought some chickens. Then I bought a fine large sow and gave $10 for her. This is about 10 years before the war. Then I raised hogs and sold them till I bought a horse.
The rich white neighbors of the claimants assert with a careless generality that so-and-so had between 50 and 100 head of whatnots, and the Federals took them all, sir. They took everything in the county. They robbed me and broke me up. So-and-so lost 10 times what he has charged the government.
This is about 8 years before freedom. This was a breeding mare, and from this mare I raised this horse which the Yankees took from me.
I pay $60 in good money for a horse. I call silver money good money. I call Confederate money wasps' nests.
I'm down in a hole. I'm down in a hole. Down in a deep, dark hole.
Only a tiny percentage of the 6,083 slaves living in Liberty County during the Civil War ever went on to file claims with the SCC. The process was long and complicated and costly. Claimants and their witnesses might travel miles from home at a time convenient for the SCC representatives, but not for people doing seasonal labor.
When they were putting in claims, I had the rheumatism and couldn't go.
And the process required a lawyer. Filing fees were paid up front, and ex-slaves quickly became indebted to attorneys who represented them, whether they eventually won an award or not.
I have not put in my claim against the government yet because I haven't seen those who put in get any money. I heard that some in Hilton Head had got some money, but I am afraid that there won't ever come any here in my lifetime.
Property stolen from slaves between 1863 and 1865 was petitioned for in SCC claims between 1871 and 1873. It took until 1880, however, for most ex-slaves to actually receive any money, if their claim or portion of it was allowed by the SCC. Compensation was only granted for property actually authorized as military supplies. A horse shot by an angry soldier, a crop trampled by passing cavalry, a lady's linen Sunday blouse ruined. These things fell under the classification of wanton destruction and were not allowed in SCC claims.
I cried when they took my property. I know I was foolish, but I couldn't help it. I was very glad to see them come, but I didn't think they would take my things.
I was worse off after the war than before. All I got was my rations, hardly as good. They took all I had, and I could not do anything for myself for a long time, and I haven't got over it.
Less than half of the Liberty County freedmen filing claims with the SCC won any award at all. On average, they asked for $332, and on average, they received only $133, about 40% of the amount they claimed. This amounts to roughly $1,720 in 1991 currency. Some estimate that lawyers took an average of 50% of any award. Successful claimants generally got their money 9 years after they filed, 15 or more years after their property was stolen.
I was worse off after the war than before, and I haven't got over it.
When you search the rain for silver cloud, and you wait on days of gold, when you pitch to the bottom, and the
the Negroes were mystified, thunderstruck that they should receive such treatment. and in some cases very severe, even cruel, at the hands of their friends.
Very soon they began to whisper that the said Yankees were only Southern men in blue clothes, that the true Yankees had not come yet.
After the war, most slaves were left landless and found they still had to work for their former masters, if not as slaves, then as wage laborers, hired by the month or by the year. For Liberty County slaves accustomed to working independently on tasks, this was unacceptable.
They had been accustomed to working by the task, which has always given them leisure to cultivate land for themselves, tend their stock, and amuse themselves.
Under the task system, slaves
learned in many instances to govern themselves and to govern each other.
Became, in their own way, as self-governing as many of small New England towns.
They raise a little corn and sweet potatoes, and with their facilities for catching fish and oysters and shooting wild game, they have as much to eat as they want, and now are quite satisfied with that.
After the war, some ex-slaves approached their former master.
They said they would be willing to take a certain piece of land, which they would cultivate for old master, and that they would take another piece of land to work for their own use. They announced that they would grant master a portion of the crop as a free gift from themselves.
To work as wage laborers, the way so many of their fellow freedmen were doing across the South,
it is a work which the Negroes are unwilling to perform.
By 1866, most freedmen in the Lowcountry were working what was called the two-day or the three-day system. This extended the task labor type of contract between ex-slave and ex-master. Freedmen worked 2 or 3 days a week on their employer's crop in return for housing, fuel, and rent-free land to work on their own time.
The laborers themselves prefer this system, having 4 days out of the week for themselves. They are more independent and can make any day they choose a holiday.
My property is my laborment.
The sharecropping and wage labor systems, so prevalent in other parts of the South, did not take root as quickly in the Lowcountry, but it was not without friction. One plantation owner reported,
"She ordered me out of her task, saying if I come into her task again, she would out me in the ditch."
Some plantation owners tried to talk sense to the freedmen, incredulous that these former slaves were insisting on better working conditions than their northern white counterparts.
Laborers at the North got less wages, worked from sunrise to sunset, only having an hour at noon.
One man indignantly asked Major D what the use of being free was if he had to work harder than when he was a slave.
The former slaves have no sense of the importance of persistent labor.
Freedmen believed if they gave way on the two-day system,
their privileges will go and their condition will be less to their taste than it was when they were slaves.
I was worse off after the war than before. All I got was my rations, hardly as good. They took all I had, and I could not do anything for myself for a long time, and I haven't got over it.
I am not willing to be a slave again, because now I can stop and rest and go about and walk some. Then when I was a slave, I could not till I got through with my task. No, sir. Be a slave, I am not willing to be that anymore.
My property is my laborment.
The years that followed did not necessarily change the bitter feelings. Former slaves, black professionals, and advocates alike reminded audiences around the country that the economic changes wrought by the Civil War were still deeply flawed. An aging W.E.B. Du Bois once commented,
"God wept, but that mattered little to an unbelieving age. What mattered most was that the world wept and is still weeping and blind with tears and blood. For there began to rise in America in 1876 a new capitalism and a new enslavement of labor."
And in the 8th decade of her own life, Sojourner Truth incited younger activists by saying,
"I want to keep the thing stirring now that the ice is cracked."
We are often destitute of the things that life demands. Want of shelter and of trusting in the Lord, and according to his word, we will understand it better by and by. Oh, children, by and by, when the morning comes, all the saints are gone together.